Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Atit in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 16, 2015. Japan helps fund major demining project in South Sudan because it says civilians are not safe.
South Sudan was breaking away with a lot of resources. Sudan felt that they were at loss. And so the whole world was looking at South Sudan to help Sudan. So South Sudan cave in.
And should South Sudan renegotiate its oil deal with Sudan? At least one analyst thinks so.
When the contingent people are working on roads and some rehabilitation projects in around Juba, they sometimes encounter unexploded ordinances. So this is a reality of the South Sudan, this is a reality of Juba.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. One of the legacies of the decades of civil war in South Sudan and more than a year of fighting between the government troops and rebels is the amount of landmines and other exploited ordnances around the country. Now, Japan has contributed $2.5 million to support mining activities in South Sudan. The United Nations says since violence broke out in Juba and spread to other parts of the country in December 2013, landmines and other explosives have been used extensively by both sides, posing the threat to civilians. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
According to the United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, the conflict has left explosives in urban areas like Bor, Malakal and Bentiu, as well as in rural agricultural and pastoral communities. UNMAS says, particularly in Unity State, there are roads shut down due to unexploded ordinances. Last year, at least 5 vehicles hit and tank landmines on roads near Bentiu. UNMAS says on its website that cluster munitions have been located on the Juba Bor Road. The agency says additional unexploded ordinances litter other areas and roads where fighting has occurred. Japan's ambassador to South Sudan, Takeshi Akamatsu, says since last year when Japan began chairing the Global Mine Action Support Group, his country has supported demining activities worldwide. He says Japan is particularly concerned about explosive remnants left over from decades of war in South Sudan, which can maim or even kill civilians. He says Japan is working to provide an explosive-free, safe environment for civilians and to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance in South Sudan as well as economic development.
We are now in kind of conflict in South Sudan, but even before this conflict arose in 2013, we were conscious that long duration of the internal conflict for the freedom of South Sudan had lots of unexploded ordinances in South Sudan, and this has been making great damage to the people and the development of South Sudan. That is why we have been always putting focus on the demining activities of South Sudan. Not only that, because this is related to our development as well. You might know that we are starting some projects in Juba, but to do that, we have to clear land.
The Japanese engineering contingent of the United Nations mission in South Sudan has been busy repairing and maintaining roads in the capital and across the country for several months now. But Akamatsu says that work stops when crews come across unexploded ordinances.
When the contingent people are working on roads and some rehabilitation projects in around Juba, they sometimes encounter unexploded ordinances. So this is a reality of the South Sudan. This is a reality of Juba. So for the security of our contingent people, we always ask these armed service people to intervene on the spot.
Akamatsu says phase one of the project involves sending in a quick response team. For phase two, Akamatsu says they plan to use dogs.
Prior to finding the mines and the ordinances by human, if we create this detection dog team to enhance this capacity, we'll be more safe because we have a prior knowledge of where the mines might be.
Akamatsu says in the last 3 years alone, Japan has contributed more than $10 million to support demining operations in South Sudan. According to the Information Management System for Mine Action Database, more than 700 sites suspected of having unexploded ordnances in South Sudan still require clearing over the next 5 to 8 years. The agency says in several urban areas and villages, unexploded mortars, rockets and hand grenades remain in the ground. Unexploded ordnances were a big problem in the region long before South Sudan became a country due to the 21-year civil war with Sudan. According to a UN report, by November 2014, more than 33,000 landmines and 850,000 items of unexploded ordnances had been destroyed in the country. The South Sudan Information Minister did not respond to calls about this story. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
South Sudan's economy, crippled by conflict and the low price of crude oil, could collapse unless a renegotiation of the 2012 cooperation agreement with Sudan is reached soon. That is the prediction of the South Sudanese analyst James Alich Garang from the Ebony Center for Strategic Planning and Studies. Garang believes any future agreement should be calculated in percentages rather than a fixed amount, as we hear from Philip Thornaleo from Juba.
South Sudan's separation from Sudan in 2011 meant Khartoum lost about 75% of its oil reserves to the new nation. To address that loss, Ali says the September 2012 deal between the two nations, known as the Cooperation Agreement, was meant to keep both countries economically viable.
South Sudan was breaking away with a lot of resources. Sudan felt that they were at loss. And so the whole world was looking at South Sudan to help Sudan. And so South Sudan came in and was able to agree that over a period of about 3 years, that South Sudan would pay over that period something close to $3 billion, what was called Transitional Financial Assistance, TFA.
Alik says when TFA is added to the transit fee, which is an amount paid for the use of Sudan's pipeline to transport oil to Red Sea port and to the global market, South Sudan faced Sudan $25 for each barrel of crude oil. Alik believes Juba made a lot of concessions in that agreement that hurt Juba.
It was as if those agreements were written in the stone. And those who were negotiating thought that oil prices would keep going up. When you look back, you would think that that was a mistake. Why? The assumption that oil price would go up or they would remain what they were. They were about $100 per barrel. Now, with the tumbling of the oil crisis across the globe, if the oil were below 50, it meant that South Sudan was paying half of its barrel to Khartoum. At that point, Khartoum was feeling richer and South Sudan was feeling poorer. And the initial thought was that we wanted to make sure that no country is a disadvantage. Now, at the end of the day, when oil prices were down, it seemed as if South Sudan is now a disadvantage.
Ali says South Sudan should negotiate new deal with Khartoum as soon as possible. Stephen Diu Dao, the National Minister of Petroleum and Mining, suggested in February that South Sudan should initiate a fresh discussion about the fair barrel fees paid to Sudan. His Sudanese counterpart, Makawi Mohammed, led a team from Khartoum early this month during a meeting both sides described as important. Ali says those meetings are vital for both countries. He says South Sudan should ask for an extension of the period to pay the so-called TFA from 3 years to about 6 years. And he says the two countries should move away from peak figures to a more rational formula like percentages.
The oil is a volatile commodity. It has to be put in a percentage term. For the case of South Sudan now, if this were in a percentage term, whatever little we are receiving now would just be paying percentage of that to Khartoum, and there's no issue. But because it was fixed $25, even if the price of dollar now, the price of barrel goes down to 30, we would still be paying $25. That means South Sudan would only be remaining with $5 for every barrel, and that is a bad thing.
Ali says seeing oil fields in Unity State were shut down after the violence began in December 2013, South Sudan has faced serious economic problems.
Yeah, we call them twin crises. The oil shutdown of 2012 brought about the austerity measures, which were fell across. And then there was the thinking that by the end of toward the end of 2013, that these austerity measures would be lifted, but then we have the conflict coming in. So these two crises dealt a big blow on the economy. Last week, what was it? There was the rioting going on in Wau. So there are financial constraints all along.
Authorities in Wau say the police rioting in the capital of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state was quelled down when unpaid salaries from January and February were paid last week. Ali says obtaining loan may be the only option to close the financial gap caused by the conflict and low global prices for crude. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
Sudan's president is on the campaign trail standing for re-election next month. President Omar al-Bashir is telling voters that disputed Abyei region is part of the Sudan and will remain a part of Sudan. Despite the unresolved status of Abyei, Sudan's Electoral Commission has said Abyei residents will be allowed to vote in the election. VOA's James Batty spoke with South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei, who says, according to the terms of the CPA, President Bashir is wrong about Abyei.
The statement of President Bashir is his opinion, but the agreements that are governing Abyei are very clear. The Abyei protocol gives the people of Abyei the right to self-determination so that they determine their destiny. We are still waiting for the AU and the IGAD and the African Union and the UN to operationalize the provisions of the Abyei protocol. That is to conduct a referendum in Abyei so that the people of Abyei determine their destiny.
This is kind of, a slap in the face of South Sudan. He's speaking to the youth in the Abyei region not to be deceived by taking up arms. And he's quoted as saying that, look at what is happening in South Sudan. They can't even take care of South Sudan. We do not want the destruction that happened in South Sudan to move here.
They are the ones who did the destruction in Abyei. So there is actually nothing in Abyei to be rescued. What the government of South Sudan is saying is, yes, Abyei is a disputed area. And as long as the dispute is not resolved, none of us have the right to claim it.
Don't you think he's talking about the inability of both the rebels and the government in South Sudan to come to some peace agreement to end the war?
Bringing peace to South Sudan has nothing to do with Abyei. As the government of South Sudan, we are longing for that time when the people of Abyei will be given the right to determine their destiny. In lieu of that, the government of the South Sudan would actually prefer to put Abyei under a UN mandate. And the fate of Abyei cannot be anchored on peace in South Sudan.
Don't you think, Mr. Minister, he's talking about, you know, if you want to be a babysitter, if you want to establish a daycare center, you must know how to take care of one child before anybody can entrust you with two or three children.
South Sudan is not a babysitter. South Sudan is an independent institution with its sovereignty. Abyei is a disputed area between South Sudan and Sudan. The conflict in South Sudan has no connection in any way with the resolution of Abyei problem.
Michael Makuei is South Sudan's information minister. He spoke with VOA's James Batty from Juba. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Student journalism clubs are created across South Sudan. Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can we fight stigma for people living with HIV and AIDS?
By educating the community that they should love them, by involving them in various situations, by counseling them, by showing them love.
It's all about a campaign and a mobilization to those people and their families so that they can get to know that after acquiring AIDS or being infected, a person can live, a person can contact doctors and hospitals and get retrovirus.
For me, AIDS is a disease like others. So we have to treat them like everyone, because me or you tomorrow can be affected also.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese journalists have a new vehicle for making their voice heard. Last week, UNESCO launched the South Sudan Journalism Students Press Clubs, which aim to support media freedom and give budding journalists a new platform. Waka Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Members of the Journalism Students Press Club applaud at the official launch of the organization in Juba. The new club is supported by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Education Organization, or UNESCO. It's the first of its kind in South Sudan, and students from the University of Juba, Catholic University, Christian University and Cavendish University have already signed up. Salah Khalid is the UNESCO country representative in South Sudan. Khalid says the ideals of the journalism club are drawn directly from Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which states that everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression to seek and spread information and ideas through any media.
We hope to increase the space for freedom of expression, freedom of information online and offline.
Khalid says one of the key things the club will do is allow UNESCO to support the training of student journalists. He says club members need to improve their writing skills and be educated about laws affecting the media, including those against hate speech and inaccurate reporting.
As I'm saying in every single occasion, freedom comes with responsibility.
Maha Sudik is the chairperson of the Journalism Students Club. She is pursuing a bachelor's degree at the College of Natural Resources and Environmental Studies at the University of Juba. She says she joined the club because it gives members an avenue to voice concerns about challenges on campus.
Through this club, we will be able to address issues which are really, you know, like problems that in within the university and challenges that faces the student in the university. So through the student themselves, because they are the one who really suffered from those problems. And then through writing their articles, we are going like to express it and bring it out to the people so that we can be able to fix it and find the right solution for those problems.
Kenneth Adam is the acting director of quality education at the South Sudan Ministry of Education. He was the guest of honor at the launch of the club. He says UNESCO effort is very timely.
We are at war, and this is really a very good time for you to be able to reflect and to educate the common people who do not understand why are we in war. Peace really is really very important for us to achieve in the country.
Journalists in South Sudan have the right to freely express themselves and gather information under the country's transitional constitution and media laws that were signed last year by President Salva Kiir. Just over 2 years ago, South Sudan became the first pilot country for a United Nations initiative aimed at protecting journalists against the harassment and creating a free and safe environment for them to work in. But in spite of the legal protections and the UN action plan, South Sudanese journalists say their rights have been seriously eroded since the country erupted in violence 15 months ago. Several newspapers have had their print runs seized and journalists have been detained after running stories that the government disagreed with. Last month, South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe once again warned journalists not to report the views of rebels fighting the government. Media outlets say that makes it difficult to tell a balanced story. Dut Peter Garang is pursuing his bachelor's in mass communication at Cavendish University. He is specializing in print media. Like other students in the UNESCO Bhakti Club, Garang will have to post the stories he produces on a website run by the students themselves. Garang says that aspect of the club will give him a platform most South Sudanese journalism students lack. He says he also hopes the club will give him the tools he needs to deal with the many threats and challenges faced by South Sudanese journalists.
I cannot stop joining in that because there is insecurity for journalists. I have to get into it and also witness and try to handle to come up with the best solution to it.
For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
And now we turn to Ebola crisis in Africa. 5 months ago, when the crisis was at its height, social life in Liberia was at a standstill, as people tried to avoid touching to keep themselves from catching the deadly virus. And with new Ebola cases now down to zero, Liberians have returned to popular beaches and nightclubs. Beno Muchla reports that people are glad social life has returned, even though the worries have not entirely faded away.
It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon, almost too nice for work. Monrovia lay under a blue sky, the ocean roared. Dripping all over, 28-year-old Derek Tamba has just had a dip in the water with friends.
I started coming back to the beach right after the government. First, they announced that they were lifting up the curfew, and they also announced that the reopening of schools. So looking at those informations, I thought it wise, I come back to the beach. I think it's a time where we can come back and reflect and just enjoy the kudo times we used to have with our friends all the year.
Unlike months ago during the height of the Ebola crisis, many people are on Monrovia's beaches. With the infection rate at zero for weeks, social life has returned to normal. Liberians enjoy their street food and share meals and drinks again with each other. They are cramming into public buses and cabs without worry. They also flock to churches where chlorine for disinfecting hands remains in buckets at the entrance. And with curfews being lifted, Liberians have also returned to nightclubs. 5 months ago, Exodus Bar in central Monrovia already closed at 9 p.m. on a Saturday night. Fast forward to a Saturday night in March, it was filled to the brim with people who stayed until the early morning hours. But not everybody feels comfortable. Honey Davis sits outside on a terrace quietly sipping a beer. She says she only came out tonight to celebrate her sister's wedding, but avoids the melee inside and shaking people's hands.
I just sit, like, hiding myself, ain't no from people, because I know one way or the other friends will see me and want to say hi. So, I mean, that's why I sit in this corner trying to just have one or two brothers and go home.
Ebola impacted every aspect of social life, including relationships. Two brothers in their early 20s, Jamal and Isaiah Williams, said 5 months ago they avoided intimacy with their girlfriends as a precaution. While Isaiah had broken up in the meantime, he said it was not due to Ebola, and people are again close with each other.
After Ebola has subsided in Liberia, right, normal activity will resume, and the sadness will be too high.
His brother Jamal was also again on good terms with a friend whom he had avoided because there was a case of Ebola in his family. But Jamal now has another, much bigger problem.
All of the little cash we had before the Ebola crisis, we used everything during the crisis. So there was nothing left to actually help us in getting back to school, in doing other things.
Jamal says he struggles to find a job and does not know what to do. The rent for the brother's small room in the Lakpadze area of Monrovia is long overdue. He applied for work at several places, even walked all the way to his representative's office on Capitol Hill because he did not have the money for transport. But he has not heard back from anyone. Jamal said even though social life has returned to Liberia, that does not mean things are okay. Liberians still face the same problems as before the Ebola crisis. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Monrovia.
The number of Central Africans fleeing to neighboring Cameroon has fallen drastically, in indication that violence may be subsiding in Central African Republic, but many of the refugees in Cameroon are reluctant to return home out of fear of poverty, hunger, and having to rebuild their lives with an uncertain future. Moki Edwin Kinzaka traveled to eastern Cameroon on the border with Central African Republic and has this report.
Najat Rushdie, a United Nations coordinator in Cameroon, says the last major surge of Central African refugees into Cameroon was in February, following a spate of farmer-herder violence that saw 50,000 people displaced. But she says, generally, numbers had started to dwindle even before then.
Les conséquences de la crise centrafricaine et l'afflux absolument important des réfugiés.
She says the influx of Central African refugees has been reduced And she says because of all the United Nations relief agencies and assistance from the government of Cameroon and international donors, they were able to contain the humanitarian crisis. Zambala Nwezo, a 52-year-old barber, was among last month's new arrivals in Cameroon. He says he left the northern CAR town of Braia when soldiers came in to quell escalating violence between herders and farmers, and life became unbearable.
Nous sommes vraiment très heureux, nous sommes en paix. Comme tout à l'heure, c'est un bœuf que lui-même il a engraissé.
He says he has just found happiness and peace in Cameroon. Those who have been in Cameroon a longer time say they are better off here than at home. 40-year-old Mama Ruifa came to Gado Bazeri, one of Cameroon's largest refugee camps, a year ago. She says she lost everything in CAR and is not thinking of going back to her country. She says she still has bad memories of how her husband, brother-in-law, and two daughters were killed in front of her, and all of her property was destroyed. She says she prefers to sell beans and groundnuts here to be able to take care of her remaining daughter. But life as a refugee remains very hard. Zambale Nwezo says the main difficulty for refugees in Cameroon is access to basic health care.
Les difficultés que nous avons dans notre village, beaucoup plus les distances de centres de santé.
He says access to health centers and schools for their children is very difficult. He says children and women suffer a lot as they have to cover long distances in search of drinkable water, while men also cover long distances to get water for their cattle. Male refugees also complain women and children are given more attention by humanitarian agencies. Anne Job of the Cameroon's Red Cross says there are many more women and children in need.
Là où nous pouvons parler de différence est au niveau, par exemple, des spécificités.
She says although they do not discriminate between men and women when attending to their health needs, they cannot allow pregnant women and breastfeeding mothers to do labor-intensive work because they need special care. The UNHCR says some 900,000 people were displaced after violence erupted in 2013 in the Central African Republic when a coup sparked sectarian bloodshed. About half of the displaced are now living in Cameroon, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Republic of Congo, most under very tough conditions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Gado Bazeri, Cameroon.
And that is our show for this Monday. We leave you now with the song Tong Tong by Sweet Jay from Yambio, Western Equatoria State. We've been listening to Sweet Jay with the song Tong Tong. I'm Michael Atit in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.